Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast, where this week we're going to be discussing the implications of the coronavirus for the global political economy. And we're going to be doing that with none other than a friend of the podcast, former US ambassador to Germany, John Emerson. So make sure you join us for that after the following brief messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast with me, Guy Foster. I'm the head of research at Bruin Dolphin. This week, we're very happy to have coming back to the podcast John Emerson, who you may recall is a diplomat, a former ambassador for the US to Germany, and then therefore has a tremendous insight into such things as the domestic politics of America and global diplomacy as well. So, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Guy. It's great to be back with you, and certainly hope you and your family and all of our listeners are doing well and staying healthy and safe.
Likewise. Yes, thank you. Thanks for that. Absolutely. Well, look, let's start with a nice, easy one then. In terms of thinking about what we've got going on at the moment with the coronavirus and everything like that, there are a lot of people who are quite reluctant to speculate on what the lasting consequences of this might be. But I know from our discussions in the past, John, that you're not someone who is that reluctant. So why don't you just outline for us at a high level what you think the consequences of this this terrible state of affairs is likely to be for society in general and the economy that we live in?
Well, thanks, Guy. I guess with the caveat that there's a lot more that we don't know than what we do know, and that this is obviously an unprecedented situation. We actually have dual crises going on here. We have a public health crisis, a global public health crisis, and then as a consequence of government action that has been taken around the world to address that public health crisis, we also have obviously a massive economic crisis that seems to be even larger than what we went through with the global financial crisis. But the one difference between this situation and the global financial crisis is that we actually know that this will end, and we know exactly how it will end. It will end essentially when we've developed a vaccine that can be widely disseminated. That may be, we may be 18 to 24 months away from that. It takes a while to not just develop the vaccine, but to test it and get it widely disseminated. Secondly, a little more quickly, hopefully, we'll have treatments developed, pharmaceutical treatments, so that fewer of the fatalities, and that would allow us to perhaps reopen the economy sooner. And then I think in some parts of the world, I know some developing countries, they don't really have the healthcare infrastructure to deal with this. They're counting on herd immunity. The fact that the virus will just flow through the community and burn itself out, that obviously results in a lot of fatalities. But by the same token, it's a combination of the three of those that will allow us to get back. And it's, I think, useful to think about what are some of the dynamics that are likely to persist. One is an interesting one is just sort of what's the role of government in general. For sure, the role of government in society is increasing. I mean, we see that with these massive sustainability and rescue packages that, you know, the United States, the EU, the UK, Germany, Japan, other countries are implementing to try to mitigate the economic crisis. We see it with the dramatically expanded role of the central banks. But at the end of the day, there's going to be a question, did government, this larger, more expanded, more activist government approach, do enough to protect us? And if people feel that it did, and right now that seems to be the sense, I mean, you look at Europe and the approval numbers that Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron have, I don't think they've ever been higher. And it sort of is reversing this hollowing out of the governing center that people were writing about so much in the last couple of years. But if there's a sense that government failed to protect people, I think you could see a return, a pretty dramatic return to the populist sentiments and dynamics that we were experiencing, particularly in the wake of the refugee crisis a few years back.
So do you think that the sort of classically American emphasis on freedom has made it harder to deal with the crisis, to create this resistance to locking down quite early, resistance to tracking cases or rolling out testing sooner?
But I think that's a really intriguing question, the thing about America freedom, because you've seen it cut in both ways. On one level, I think Americans have actually been pretty good in at least states or communities where we've seen an outbreak of the virus. Americans have been really good at sheltering in place and putting up with it and trying to accommodate their lives in a way to comply with that requirement. But what we also see, and particularly with young people, and of course, I'm sure you saw the pictures of spring break beaches in Florida and that kind of thing. Young people who often think they're invulnerable anyway. And now we're beginning to see in some of these protests, which, be honest with you, I think some of them are in some areas where they've been encouraged by some of President Trump's statements and tweets. But in some of these protests against the sheltering in place, against the lockdowns, you're beginning to see a sense of that, let us make our own decision, let us be free. We don't want to have government telling us what to do. Now, interestingly enough, you don't really see those places, those protests in places like New York City or even Los Angeles or San Francisco or certainly not in Detroit. You're seeing them more in some of the suburban and more rural areas that have yet to be touched so dramatically by the wave of the coronavirus or coronavirus infections. And so it'll be interesting to see how that works. I mean, my sense is the economy will begin to open in a gradual, almost not wave, but ripple-like manner where areas that have not yet been touched by COVID-19 start to open first, probably gradually, small groups of people, okay, not the large groups, not big sporting events or concerts or that kind of thing. And it'll be interesting to see whether the virus does get introduced in those areas and then how people react in point of fact if it does. But I do think you're seeing right now, as you turn on the television and see some of these protests, that does play into that sort of American sense of freedom, and I'm not going to have government tell me what to do.
Yeah, and that's obviously more prevalent on the Republican side as well, isn't it? So there's a sense in which things have become that every issue in America has become increasingly partisan. From the outside, it certainly looks like this is a somewhat partisan issue, and it might be down to the geographical spread that it hits more urban areas more intensely first. But is it? Or it might be down to a sort of cultural views on freedom. But do you think is it true that that this, like everything else, seems to be quite a partisan issue?
Well, it's getting there. It's not quite as sharply partisan as some other things. I saw a poll in the last couple of days that 62% of the Republicans are concerned about opening the economy too quickly from a standpoint of their health. Now, those are typically Republicans who live in urban areas where this has been hardly hit. If you're a Republican who lives in Westchester County, which was actually in New York, outside of New York City, which was actually the first hotspot to develop in New York, you're probably not too enthusiastic about let's reopen everything right away. But if you're a Republican who lives in the upstate New York, some of the more rural parts of the agricultural parts of New York, and you don't see any impact of this in your community, you're like, what's this all about? And I see people losing their jobs, and this isn't worth it. The whole, is the cure worse than the disease? So yes, it's partisan, but it's not quite so sharply partisan as things like, Donald Trump's approval rating, as an example, which is so much of a Republican-Democratic divide. It's more a function of where do you live. Blue state America tends to be more urban. Red state America tends to be more on the rural side. If you live in a rural area, to a great extent, this hasn't hit yet, and you're sort of, what's the fuss all about? If you live in an urban area, you get the joke, so to speak, and so you're more willing to put up with these lockdowns.
Things you mentioned was the role of government, and as you pointed out, obviously the role of government has just expanded absolutely hugely, and that's classically a very controversial thing to happen in America. How much consensus is there around the idea that this huge expansion of welfare or compensation is an appropriate and proportionate response to the crisis?
Well, I think, I mentioned earlier that there's been a dramatic difference between how policymakers have responded to this and how policymakers responded to the global financial crisis. Getting the TARP package through the United States Congress and then Obama's stimulus package, as you recall, the global financial crisis sort of bookended the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
Those were huge political fights. And yet, here we've now had, almost $3 trillion when you add up these different packages that have been spent, if you will, on almost a unanimous basis by, both Democrats and Republicans in the Congress. So that, I think, is very, very good. I think there's a sense that, the economic crisis was not a result of, an overheating of part of the economy. It was not a result of, shenanigans on Wall Street. It was a result of government action to address a public health crisis. And so therefore, government has a greater responsibility to try to mitigate the consequences of that action. And I think there's also a recognition that if you can keep people somehow tied to their jobs, so for instance, this relief to small businesses, it's structured as a loan, but it's a loan that gets forgiven if you keep 80% of your employees on payroll during the next eight weeks it is. And I think they're obviously going to have to put more money into it to extend it. Because obviously, if you have people on payroll, it's a lot easier to restart your business. They aren't necessarily going on unemployment, and the economy will come back more quickly under those circumstances. So there's also, that sense. And then I think, the third piece is a recognition that we have a whole lot of people in our economy today who work in what's known as the gig economy, the Uber drivers, a lot of people who are waiters, or they entertainers. So all of those folks, they don't really qualify typically for unemployment insurance. But under these new rules that have come out under this stabilization package, they are qualified to apply for unemployment insurance. And so it's a way to get money directly into the hands of people who may have a lot of trouble, or maybe impossible for them to pay the next month's rent, or even to put food on the table during this period of time when they just can't be out working. Interestingly enough, recently there's been a lot of commentary in sort of economic papers and even on things like, CNBC and Bloomberg News about this, quote, modern monetary theory, which is the idea that if you print your own money, you can keep spending, almost without consequence. Now, that's a little hard to believe that it's without consequence ultimately, but there's the idea of debt and deficit spending is much less of a problem, I think, politically than it's ever been before in this country. So I think we're probably going to see more of this. And as we get into the summer and fall, we may even see a stimulus package. I know both President Trump and some of the Democrats in Congress have talked about a big infrastructure spending package to try to put people back to work.
It's a really interesting point you make there, and I think I was asking about the degree of consensus around it, and the idea, I suppose, as you talk about a stimulus package coming at a time in advance of an election, so normal politics would make that something that you'd expect the opposition to be pretty cynical about. Certainly in our own electoral cycle, the last general election in the UK was much less divided in terms of these lines of fiscal prudence from the right, a more expansive fiscal policy from the left. What is the US election going to be fought over if you've got the sort of free spending Republican president and these free spending Republican policies?
Well, you know, what's interesting is you have a free spending Republican president. You don't necessarily, you know, the deficit hawks in Congress haven't all gone away. So you see, for instance, with this talk of infrastructure, you see pushback coming from, you know, Mitch McConnell, who's a Republican leader of the Senate, and others on that, even against their own president. You know, and so that's why I think an infrastructure package will be probably more some Republicans, a lot of Democrats, and the White House, should that come along. But I'll tell you what the election will be fought over. It's something pretty well unrelated to that, except insofar as that might have good consequences for the economy. The election will no longer be fought over a referendum on how Donald Trump handled the economy and how he handled himself personally during the past, you know, 3.5 years. That was sort of the frame that we were looking at 2 months ago. Now, this election will be a referendum on how Donald Trump handled the dual crises of a public health, global public health pandemic and the economic shutdown. And I think that is a more challenging frame for the election for Donald Trump than the previous what it previously looked like, and what's really interesting about it is, and there, by the way, the reason I say that is I think the what people are looking for in the way of a leader during this kind of crisis is steadiness, calmness, expertise, and experience. Truth telling, someone who's going to be straightforward with the American people. You know, it's a reason why you probably don't get much coverage of this in the UK, but the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has these very popular daily press conferences, as does Donald Trump on his end. And Cuomo's just sitting there very factually and matter-of-factly explaining what's happening with the coronavirus crisis, explaining what the next steps are, explaining what people can do to protect themselves. You get much less of that from the manner in which, you know, Donald Trump handles these press conferences. His are equal part explanation and equal part patting himself on the back about what a great job he's doing. And he'll say one thing one day and something else the next. There's an erratic aspect to that, which has been reflected in the polls. Initially, Trump got a little bit of a what we call the rally around the flag bump when the country is facing a crisis. There's a rally around the flag effect where people support the leadership in dealing with the crisis. And, you know, his poll numbers went up to the highest they ever were. Well, guess what? They're back down to where they were before. In contrast, you now have, it's very clear that the Democratic nominee will be Joe Biden. And the things that were liabilities for Biden 2 months ago have become assets. Too much a creature of Washington. He's been around forever. Well, that becomes, he's experienced. You know, he's steady. He's been through this. And he actually was through, President Obama had Joe Biden, when he was vice president, take the lead in trying to rebuild the economy coming out of the global financial crisis and take the lead in trying to save the auto industry. Back in, you know, 2009, 2010, you know, so and also, by the way, Biden's assets always were that he's a straight shooter, that he's honorable, you know, those kinds of things that, again, are the sorts of qualities that people look for in this kind of a crisis. So I think that, you know, Trump's got a challenge on his hand with a reelection. Now, of course, as everybody knows and certainly learned from 2016 and from the 2000 election, both Bush v. Gore and then Trump v. Hillary Clinton, that it's not about the popular vote. It's not about your overall poll numbers. It's about who wins the Electoral College. From an Electoral College standpoint, all Donald Trump needs to do is hold everything he won in, you know, the Republican base in 2016 and win one of the three states that he flipped last time against Hillary Clinton, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. If he just wins one of those three, Biden flips two back to the Democrats, but then Trump gets reelected president, assuming he holds everything else. So given that, I'd say the election is still very much a coin flip, but maybe a coin flip where 51 times that coin comes up in favor of Joe Biden and 49 times in favor of Donald Trump.
Okay, well, look, I've got a load of questions on that, but one of them I really want to put to you, because I keep hearing these theories that President Trump is actually much more strategically competent than he appears from the outside. And so the latest one is that his claim of holding absolute authority over when the lockdowns are lifted prompted the Democratic governors to say, actually, no, that's not true. It's down to us to decide how the lockdowns are lifted, and that he's basically tricked them into taking responsibility for what is essentially an extremely difficult decision, and one where there's going to be a clamour from the populace to try and get the economy open too early, which would be politically disastrous, and where prudence is just going to be politically pretty unpopular. What do you think? Is that affording him too much political nous?
Well, let me tell you something. Donald Trump is a genius when it comes to manipulating the media, understanding how to create a story. For 10 years, he was the star of a reality television show that was top rated in many of the parts of the country where he currently has his support. So I don't underestimate his, ability to sort of frame a storyline at all. Now, he said from the beginning, I take no responsibility for this. Nobody could have seen this coming, even though obviously a lot of people saw it coming. He's obviously trying to escape blame from being slow off the mark in terms of responding to this. I think that, it sounds like you've got some of the same conversations happening in the UK that'll pick up some steam as people start, dissecting what happened and why and how on this thing. And there's no question that Trump's entire strategy has always been to find somebody to blame for bad news. It was Obama's fault. It was my predecessor's fault. He does that all the time. And so, that's what happened. The only thing I would disagree with you on this is it wasn't just Democratic governors who said, no, it's us. There were also Republican governors as well. Governor DeWine in Ohio, who has been equally forceful to some of the Democratic governors in terms of closing things down. Governor Charlie Baker in Massachusetts and Governor Hogan in Maryland. Now, what do Ohio, Massachusetts, and Maryland have in common? Well, they're not all blue states, because Ohio is it's pretty close to a red state. It's purple because it has a Democratic senator, but they are states with large urban populations, and that's what they have in common. The one that surprises me more than anything is Florida and Texas, both of which have sort of a mixed urban and rural population. And in Florida in particular has a old population. The whole coastal area of Florida is retirees from, the East Coast and the Midwest. So I find that somewhat surprising, the almost cavalier attitude that governor has taken. But he's very much following the line of Trump. And I think you're right. Donald Trump has set himself up. So if it goes badly, either way, economy, we're still in an economic crisis because we, quote, didn't open up quickly enough, or we have a massive public health crisis because, quote, we opened up too quickly, he can sit there and go, hey, wasn't me. It was those guys, and they insisted that it was their right to do it. So I think you're right on that.
Let's just answer some of the things which I guess will be really weighing on the minds of people who don't really don't understand all of the details of the American electoral system. So firstly, like, is this thing even going to go ahead? in November? Is it going to be possible to hold an election and a campaign and stuff?
Absolutely. We held it during the, you know, we had a midterm elections during the 1918 elections, and, you know, during the Spanish flu. We held our elections during the midst of, you know, World War One, during the midst of World War Two, during the Great Depression. Absolutely, we're going to have an election. It will look like a different kind of election. I think by and large, it'll be a vote by mail election. I know that in many states, there'll be the option to go to the polls on election day. The lines will be long and, you know, people will be socially distancing for sure, particularly if we have that second wave that everyone's predicting in the, you know, fall and winter come back. The nature of the campaign, I think, will be quite different. You're not going to have these large group rallies and, you know, the pressing of the flesh, as they say, that is so typical of campaigns. It's what you will have is an election that I think digital advertising and digital media will become even more important, you know, less in, you know, big rallies and public events and more on the small screen. I think, you know, the debates may take on a great significance as well. But the election will happen for sure. I don't see any circumstance where the election itself is postponed. And interestingly enough, by our Constitution, the president and the vice president are in power only until January 20th of the next year. So even if they don't have an, because there's been some speculation, would Trump try to delay the election? Even if they don't have an election, president and vice president, they're gone as of January 20th. Then the question is, who succeeds them? How does that succession work? Very complicated. I can't imagine there are too many Americans who actually want to go there. So I see this happening very much on a vote-by-mail basis.
When do we know who Joe Biden's running mate will be for this election? And who's it going to be?
When he announces it. And, you know, there's two schools of thought. One school of thought is, look, he's already unified the party, which, by the way, is something that no one expected 2 months ago. 2 months ago, I mean, people thought, okay, Biden will probably get the nomination, but it's going to be toe-to-toe with Bernie Sanders, just like 2016. He's going to have to come out of the convention with a real challenge of unifying the party. Well, boom, right now the party's unified. Sanders dropped out, endorsed Biden. Elizabeth Warren dropped out, endorsed Biden, and on and on. And so he, you know, theoretically, he could name the vice president, you know, today. Now, my understanding is they're just in the process of beginning the vetting, the, you know, sort of quiet analysis of the records and the public statements and so on and so forth. You don't want to announce somebody as vice president that hasn't been thoroughly vetted and ends up, you know, creating problems. I think Sarah Palin probably is a pretty good example of what can happen under those circumstances. You know, that takes a couple of months. I mean, literally, you've got lawyers going through their tax returns and all that kind of thing to see, because, you know, the press will be doing it the minute they're announced. So you want to know the good and bad and the ugly in terms of any of these nominees. And but the one school of thought is, well, he ought to do it sooner rather than later, because that gives him, first of all, it'll be a woman. So you're going to have, for sure, a female vice presidential candidate nominated, you know, younger, dynamic, you know, out there, helping the campaign and sort of, you know, doubling the echoing what he's doing or what have you. Right now, it's all Corona, Corona, Corona. And even if it would be a big announcement and big news for a day or two, but it would just get, the momentum would get lost in all the coverage of the Corona pandemic and the fact that we're dealing with that. And that, in point of fact, it's probably smarter to wait until hopefully things have quieted down somewhat as we get into the late summer, into the fall. You make the announcement when they normally do, which is typically, the weekend before the convention. That's when most of these announcements get made these days. And that would be like the third week of August. And then you ride that momentum into the fall. My guess is that's probably the approach that he'll take. So I think you'll see a lot of speculation in the press, but I don't think you'll see someone named until midsummer at the earliest.
Okay, all right. Well, I think we're rapidly running out of time. It's been a very fascinating conversation. I think maybe just before you go, would you be able to give us a few comments on Germany that you have such good knowledge of?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, I think you're right. I mean, Germany gets pretty high marks for the way it's handled this. They move pretty quickly to get the testing capabilities. I mean, Germany is now testing 650,000 people a week. The fact is that Angela Merkel acted quickly, and I think that, to my point about the kind of leadership that people are looking for in this kind of a crisis, the fact that you have a just the facts, ma'am, scientist as who's been around for a long time and is, just steady and calm and fact-based as a leader, we've seen that reflected in her poll numbers going up, and not just her poll numbers, but also the support for her party, the CDU, which plays into the second part of your question, which is about Merkel's succession. There's not going to be a German election, a federal election, before the normal time they would have had that election, which is September of 2021. There was some talk of early elections if the CDU picked their person in April, and wasn't sure if that would happen or not. But now for sure it's certain that Angela Merkel will remain chancellor until after that election in September of 2021. And then the second thing to keep in mind is that she assumes the reins of the presidency of the European Council starting at the end of June of this year. Now, that's going to be interesting. I mean, initially, her plan was to focus on the EU's relationship with China. They were going to have a big EU-China summit, I think, in September in Germany. Well, that's presumably, it may or may not happen, but let's just say the focus of her presidency is not going to be the EU's relationship with China. It's going to be how the EU is responding to this pandemic and how it is responding to the economic crisis, and particularly the tensions between the northern states and the southern states about getting some economic help to deal with this. So, I can't give you a who exactly will succeed Merkel. Most betting is that there will be, of course, again, a coalition government in Germany. And that coalition may well be CDU and the Greens, who in the last couple of years have actually sort of moved ahead of every other party except the CDU in the public opinion polls. So that's pretty much, what we're looking at today. And there's no question that Merkel and her party have been helped thus far by virtue of Germany's, the way Germany has responded to this.
Okay. Well, look, John, you've been extremely generous with your time. Thank you very much for running us through those that detailed account of the political situation in the US and Germany. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Bruin Podcast. We very much hope that you'll join us again in future. Thank you.